Welcome everybody to episode 19 of the Blue Skies Dronecast, the podcast by UAV Hub. This is a podcast for the UK drone industry, discussing everything from the UK regulations, new drones, and also speaking to you, the people within the drone industry. Presented this week, as always, by Tom Patterson, Adam Giorgio, and Matthew Hurst. So welcome along, everybody. This is episode 19, like I mentioned. And again, this week, we're going to be moving away from the normal sort of structure, I suppose. And we're going to be focusing on the GBC qualification. So quite a lot to talk about here, I think. And again, I think a lot of our listeners probably are potentially thinking about the GBC or have the A2 already and wondering the differences between the two potentially. So we're going to unpack exactly what it is, what it actually involves, and then some extras that you might be able to do with that qualification as opposed to the A2 CFC. So I think without further ado, we'll jump straight in, I suppose. So let's first of all talk about the actual qualification itself. So it's the GBC, and I think I'll hand this over to Adam to just give us a quick sort of overview of what it's all about. So yeah, Adam, take it away.
Okay, so there's a couple of things just to cover here. So the GBC itself, it's not a permission. It's not a permission from the CA to do anything in particular. So it's not like doing commercial work. It's a certificate, essentially a certificate of competency to do visual line of sight work. And it's used to apply to the CA to get something called an operational authorization. So whereas with the A2 CFC, you do the course, you get the certificate from your REE, so in our case, your UAV Hub. With the GVC, once you've done the course and you've got the GVC certificate, you then have to apply to the CAA to get the operational authorization. Now, the certificate itself is valid for 5 years. So you get the GBC, it's valid for 5 years, but you still have to apply to the CAA to get the operational authorization, and that's only valid for 12 months. Now, you could use the GBC itself to apply for this operational authorization at any time, as long as your GBC is valid. So, you know, let's say, for example, you finish the GBC course tomorrow, but you don't want to apply to the CA to get your operational authorization for, say, another 6 or 12 months. Well, that's absolutely fine because your GBC is still valid. You just apply when you're ready. And then sort of finally, it does allow the remote pilot to operate under another operational authorization. So for example, yeah, you do the course and you get a job elsewhere and the company has their own operational authorization. You can go into their operational authorization and operate under their authorization from the CA without having to get your own. So that's one of the big things.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and I think if we sort of backtrack a little bit and talk about maybe the old kind of equivalent, which is, I suppose, the PFCO, I think the biggest change, I would say personally, and Matthew might be able to sort of talk us through a few other changes, is the fact that now commercial operations has almost disappeared, hasn't it, from a CAA's point of view. So you now don't necessarily need a license to do commercial work. The license now just enables you to fly closer to people, essentially, now instead. And I think that's a big thing that people still get confused about. Maybe bigger companies still think, no, you need a certain qualification to use a drone commercially, and that's actually not the case anymore. So yeah, that's one of them. But Matthew, are there any other differences between the old qualification and the new?
Well, Tom, yeah, I think you've explained it in between yourself and Adam. You've explained most of the details. I think the permission is pretty similar to what you would have got with the PFCO, of course. You have very similar separation distances, etc. And of course, we'll get into the meat of that as we go through this in a bit more detail. But I think something else that people need to be aware of is the fact that there is a deadline approaching, although it's not very close at this point. But people who have a PFCO or who have gained one by having an NQE certificate will need to make the conversion to a GVC certificate within a reasonable period of time. And people are already doing that so that they're fully prepared and up to standard and sort of on top of that. Adam, you may be able to fill in with the actual sort of timing of that and when that becomes a requirement.
Yeah, so by the end of 2023, so, you know, 1st of January 2024 is probably worth pointing your diary. If you do had a PFCO and you'd done an NQE recommendation course at the time, put that in the diary, because at that point you will no longer be able to operate under an operational authorization unless you have done a GVC course and hold a general visual line of sight certificate. So if you're unsure, check your certificates, get your certificates out, you know, download them if it's all digital, and have a look at it. If it says it's a general visual line of sight certificate, you're covered. If it's the old sort of white paper that's you know, it just says it's a recommendation, then you've got an NQE recommendation certificate, in which case you're going to need to you're going to need to convert that to a GVC before the end of 2023.
Yeah, that's right. So at the moment, people can still renew as long as their OA or PFCO hasn't lapsed with that old certificate, can't they? The CAA is still accepting the NQE certificates. If you lapse, though, by even a day, then the CAA won't accept it. But by the end of 2023, or no, the end of 2022, beginning of 23.
No, you're right, 2023.
I was just like, yeah, so I'm going to get my numbers all mixed up. Then even if you haven't lapsed, they still won't accept the NQE certificate. So you will then have to convert to the GVC. So there is a sort of a hard line, isn't there, that's going to come into effect regardless of kind of what you've been doing before, I suppose.
Yeah.
Tom, cool. Maybe this is a good time to mention what's involved in that conversion process as well. I don't think we actually had it in the notes specifically, but it's just occurred to me as you've been saying that, that of course there's a couple of different variables in terms of making that conversion. Adam, maybe you could clarify that for us as well.
Yeah, so the majority of people will be able to do the GVC conversion course if the first criteria is they need to either be in or hold a current PFCO or operational authorization. That's one of the key things. It needs to be current. The next thing is if you've got the required flight logs or flight hours. So for ourselves, it's you need to have done a minimum of 2 hours in the last 3 months to prove that you've stayed competent. And we also want to see a number of hours over the period of holding your PFCO to make sure that you have stayed current. So if you want to know more details about that, do drop us an email and we can send you the exact criteria. If you haven't managed to maintain a level of currency over a period of time, you may be required to do a new flight examination. But like I said, the majority of people can just do a new theory course, theory examination, get their operations manual updated if needed, and then get their GVC authorised.
That's it. And certainly with us, that can all be done from the comfort of their own home at the moment with the online training and obviously the online exam as well, which makes it super easy and super, you know, it's sort of easy to do, I suppose, really, doesn't it? Which is great and convenient too. So with that, let's actually talk about what the actual course involves then, shall we? So obviously we mentioned there's going to be sort of an element of theory and it's very similar to the A2 theory. So if people have already done that, it's kind of building on top of that learning, I suppose, really. So there's about 8 or 9 hours worth of online learning with a number of different modules. And basically it's making sure that you understand that you have to use and operate your aircraft safely and within in accordance with the rules and regulations issued by the CAA. Once the theory is passed and you've passed the multiple choice exam, we then move on to the flight test. So obviously different from the A2, there actually is a practical element to this course, which is the flight test. And again, we have touched upon this in previous episodes, but maybe Matthew can give us a quick breakdown of the actual OE process.
Of course, yeah. So the OE refers to an operational evaluation, which is basically just our internal name for the flight test. As you say, Tom, we have actually had quite a lengthy discussion about this before, so people can look back in the catalogue of recordings and see and look out for that if they want to get more detail on it. But I can certainly give a quick overview for sure. So I think the first thing that I always like to say, and I often say this to people when we do a face-to-face type theory examination, is do not panic about the flight test. It's really not end of the world stuff. It's not as challenging or as intimidating as a driving test, for example. If you come well prepared, your chance of a pass is really, really good. So generally speaking, they're normally conducted at a UAV hub facility, and we've got a number of them, an expanding network of them across the country. And at the moment, I think we've got, Tom, what is it, about 5 or so at the moment?
Yeah, I think 5 or 6, I think now, which is, yeah, pretty good going. Yeah, we've got a few more in the pipeline, hopefully, but yeah, that's about the right number at the moment, yeah.
That's right, yeah. So we've just had an additional one come online in the last couple of days. I call it 6 then. So there's about 6 locations at the moment that you can go and do your flight test, which of course covers most areas of England and Scotland already. So of course that'll become better and better as we get more examiners online. But yeah, you'll be heading out to one of our facilities to go and do your flight test. And of course we'll provide plenty of guidance ahead of time as part of the course itself. Do take the time to read through that guidance and gain as much information and sort of footing as you can before you head out. The preparation is as important as the flying skill on the day. So, and the better prepared, as we said in our talk about it, the better prepared you are, the easier and more comfortable it's going to be for you as well. So it's designed as a sort of proactive exercise in that we really assess what you're capable of. And at the same time, I think, Tom, you probably agree that we also put out little bits of information and tips as we work through the process. It's not purely checking what the person can do. It's also feeding a bit of information and teaching odds and ends as they make small mistakes. So I think it's a very valuable opportunity, in fact, for people who haven't been through the process before. And all of our guys are well qualified to be able to offer that guidance and assistance. So to make the most of that and take that on board for sure. But in terms of the process itself, in effect, we give you a commercial task to do, which is a simple task, but you need to basically plan towards that and handle it as though you're doing the task for a client. So you'll meet out in the field, and of course, we'll go through the planning with you. We'll make sure that you're comfortable with the planning exercise and do a review of your documentation on site. We'll then move over to the pre-flight checks of the aircraft, etc., leading up to the actual flight itself. And during the flight, that's also broken into a couple of sections where we'll do the commercial task, and then there's also a set of prescribed maneuvers which we'll need to complete as well. Now, the standard that we expect is relatively high. As I say, good preparation is going to be essential, but at the same time, we aren't measuring geometrical precision of your maneuvers and so on. It's really just making sure that you're fully in control of the aircraft and you understand its systems and that you're able to operate it safely overall.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that's very well explained as well. I would say a couple of tips for people. And obviously, I've done quite a few flight tests. And Matthew, you're closely behind me, I think, as well. I would say give yourself some time and then potentially double the amount of time you think it's going to take you, because the people that haven't done so well can fly quite well, but they haven't given enough time for the planning and the safety gear and everything that you kind of need to think about and sort of almost bring together. So give yourself loads of time, arrive with, you know, at least an hour to spare, because again, you don't want the stress of some traffic or other problems. And if you arrive relatively chilled out with everything ready to go, then the exam will probably go in a similar fashion, I suppose, too, really. So that's my top tip, I suppose, really. Have you got a top tip as well, Matthew? Anything to add to that, do you think?
I think the other thing that I've said previously is put the hours in terms of doing flight training as well, so that ultimately you're able to focus on your spatial awareness and that sort of thing, and you're not purely thinking about left, right, forwards, backwards. That should all be very natural by the time you arrive for your flight test. So I think put the hours in, make sure that you're well prepared in terms of your flight skill as well. And as you've said, Tom, generally speaking, the planning tends to be the weaker aspect for most people. So equally important, of course, is the preparation of the plan and flight planning.
Yeah, exactly. And we obviously set you up with that in the theory learning with a module dedicated to the flight planning side of things too. Yeah. So hopefully everything should kind of follow suit with that as well. Brilliant. Okay, so let's pretend we've now aced our theory, we've aced our flight test. What's the next step? And it's probably the one that has the biggest kind of stigma behind it, I suppose, really. And that's the operations manual, I suppose, too. So I'll hand this over to Adam and he can kind of explain what the operational manual or operations manual even is and how you go about sort of creating one.
OK, so the operations manual itself is a document. It's quite a hefty document, actually, that outlines how you're going to operate safely. So it's got all of your procedures in there. It's got all the technical details to do with your aircraft, your insurance details. It's a one-stop shop for you and your aircraft or your organisation and your fleet of aircraft. One thing I do want to point out is as part of your flight test, we do provide you with a flight planning pack-up, which does contain the key elements from an operations manual. So as part of your planning pack-up, actually, you've got all your emergency procedures there. You've got the all the setup guide. You know, it's all kind of there. What we're doing at the last stage is we're fleshing that out. You know, we're tailoring it to you. Basically, you know, we're just getting some information from you about what organization it is, whether you're a sole trader or whether you're a limited company, if you've got any other aircraft. And then what we're going to do is we're going to make things a lot easier for you. Whereas it used to be in the past that people used to write their own operations manual from scratch, you know, we literally used to send out headers. You know, that was it. You know, you got had headers and it was fill this in.
No, that's all the CIA gave, wasn't it, as help. That was their guide. It was just, 20 headings, and that was about it.
That's it. You know, we've, over the years, we've, essentially made it a lot easier for people, because I think whereas before a lot of people were flying potentially a lot of custom-built aircraft, having their, had their own setups and whatnot, the majority now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say over 95% of people are flying a DJI aircraft. More than likely, something like a Mini 2 or a Mavic 2, I would argue the majority of. So actually, the operations manual has become pretty standardized, actually, of what you need to do and what needs to be in it. So like I say, what we've done is we've made it super simple. Is once you've completed your flight examination, you fill in a form. It's fairly straightforward. It'll take you no more than 5 minutes to do. We then take those details, pop them into an operations manual, flesh it out, make sure everything's correct, make sure it's correct for the aircraft that you're flying, I say details of your company or whether you're a sole trader, and then that gets then sent back to you, and then it's your manual, okay? So it's your manual to look at, understand, read it through. Don't just kind of go, looks all right. If you don't understand it, then you need to let us know. You know, again, it's your manual at the end of the day. And if you do want to make any changes to it, you can do so. Again, it's your manual. But what we send you is a fully formed, fully fleshed out manual ready to go to the CAA. You technically, you shouldn't really need to do anything to it. But if you do, that's entirely up to you. You do have that autonomy to do that. You know, we're not going to say, no, you can't change that. You can't have that font. That's down to you.
That's it.
Like I say, that gets sent to you. You sign that off. You let us know if there needs to be any changes, anything. It's a different aircraft, or whatever. And we essentially then sign you off and send you your GVC. Sorry, Matthew. I've just got one little
point to add to that is something that I think an issue that's been raised at Flight Test from time to time is that I think it's important that people understand, going on from what you've said, that they need to understand their operations manual and operate accordingly. So it doesn't help that you have a fantastic document that lays out a brilliant safety plan and safe sort of operations by default, etc., and then you don't follow the procedures which are listed. So it's very important that you read and understand it, and that everybody that operates underneath that document also reads and understands it and is able to operate in that way. So I think that's something which I've highlighted for a lot of people in their flight tests, where you are ultimately liable for your operation. And if you're doing your own thing out in the field, different to what's documented, then you may find yourself in hot water if anything ever goes wrong.
It is, think of it as a legal document. It's a document that you've almost contracted yourself to do. So, you've sent that to the CAA. The CAA go, yep, that all looks great. If you don't do what's in that manual and you haven't got the paper trail to follow it, then actually you might be breaking the law potentially, or at least breaking the contract with the CAA for your operational authorization. So, do read it, do understand it. And if there is something in there you think, what the hell is this? What is this on about? Ask us. That's what we're here for. We're here to make sure that you operate safely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the good thing is, I think as you complete the flight test pretty much mirrors exactly what the ops manual explains. So if you can pass the flight test and, do very well, the chances are if you keep operating in that way, then you'll have no issues at all moving forward. I think that's another critical thing to sort of explain to people as well. So brilliant. So that's almost, I think, the last stages of kind of our job, I suppose, really. It's then over to the student to direct themselves to the CIA portal, I suppose, and we give you the information of where to go, and also a PDF guide as well of how to fill in this online application application form, I suppose. It's a little bit awkward. Sometimes the terminology can be a little bit tricky, so we have created this guide. And essentially, what you do is you fill in the form, you upload the operations manual that we've provided you with. You also upload your GVC certificate as well to prove that you've had a qualification from an RAE. And then finally, unfortunately, you do have to hand over some money. And this is creeping up very slightly every year, I think, unfortunately. And correct me if I'm wrong, Adam, it's £253 for the initial application. Is that right?
Yeah, so £253 at the moment. It usually increases each year with inflation. I don't think it has for the last couple of years, but I think that was mainly due to the impacts of COVID and the pandemic. But chances are next year we're probably going to see a couple of percentage increase on that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I'm sure the CAA are rubbing their hands together, I should imagine. But yeah, that's the price at the moment, currently anyway. And turnaround time, it's looking at the moment, we've seen from sort of multiple students, it's between about 7 to 14 days. That's what they're doing at the moment. However, in the terms and conditions, it does say they have up to 28 working days to actually give you back your operational authorization. So again, they're not really there to be rushed. If they are taking a little bit longer, you know, sometimes they do take slightly longer than what we've just said, but the average we're seeing at the moment is about 7 to 14 days, which is pretty good going, I think, really. And obviously then once you get that OA or operational authorization into your inbox, it's a 4-page PDF that is essentially your license, I suppose, if you want to call it that. You're qualified, you're ready to go, and you can go out and start utilizing those permissions, which is good. It's a good day when that comes through. I think people are very happy about that, and they post on Facebook, and they're great as well. Yeah, Adam. Yeah.
Yeah, so one thing I will just sort of point out about that 4-page operational authorization you get is actually, I think it's quite good now, because the CA have now almost listed absolutely everything that it authorizes you to do. So you look at, if you actually read through it, it'll tell you the distances you need to keep from whether it's uninvolved people or assemblies of people. You know, it's a solid document, actually, whereas I think the old PFCO document actually could read quite confusingly, I thought. You know, it never read well, whereas this, actually, it's all boxed off, literally boxed off into sections that outline exactly what you can now do. So again, worth a read.
Yeah, I see. Brilliant. So we've almost got to the end of kind of the qualification, I suppose, really. But how long does the OA last for? Obviously, we've spoken about the actual GVC qualification. That lasts for 5 years. But the OA has to be renewed, I think, Matthew. What's that? Sort of more details about that side of things.
Yeah, Tom, you're dead right. So, of course, the OA, well, not of course, the answer is the OA is valid for 12 months. So it's, of course, valid for a year and needs yearly renewal, at which point you will also need to submit your operations manual again, having been updated to the current standard at the time of the renewal. And, of course, there's a cost to the renewal as well. So currently the renewal cost is £190, so considerably less than the original application. But, of course, the CAA, in effect, are still doing the same work. Because you submit your operations manual again, they're doing the same review of your documentation and so on. So yeah, yearly renewal, £190, and that gets you set for another 12 months ahead.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. Adam, I think you're going to say what I'm going to say.
I was going to say flight logs.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. That's it. So we just need to make sure. Yeah, sorry, I'll quickly just explain that. So the flight logs, very simple. You just need to also prove to the CAA that you have done the minimum amount of flying to make sure you're still current. So it is a minimum of 2 hours in the last 3 months. So the CAA will also want the ops manual again updated. They'll want another bit of money off you, like we've mentioned before. And they'll also want flight logs to prove that you've done a minimum of 2 hours in the last 3 months. And if that's all good and they're happy with everything, then you'll get another year's worth of your OA renewed. Adam, was there anything else?
Yeah, so just in regards to the you resubmitting your operations manual as part of your renewal, we've already kind of said you need to make sure it's up to date. And I just want to quickly touch on, well, how do you know whether it's up to date? And the key thing is, well, this is something you should be doing throughout the year. You shouldn't just be leaving it to the last minute. I will point out you can renew an operational authorization up to 90 days before it expires. So, you know, 3 months before it expires, you can start to renew for the following year. You don't lose out. You don't lose that 3 months. It'll just get, you'll get 12 months from the end of the expiry date. So, you know, 3 months beforehand, get it in, get it renewed, and then you don't have to think about it for another 12 months and you've still got 3 month buffer. But in terms of, you know, what do you need to check? What do you need to, you know, make sure is up to date? Well, you know, the most simplest thing really is usually the CAP documents. You've got your reference table within your ops manual. It is referencing certain documents. Hit up your favorite search engine, whatever that is, you know, and type in whether it's the CAP 722, is it the latest version? Is it, has the date changed? You know, you go through all these meticulously. There might be terminology that's changed potentially. You might need to delve into other documentation, make sure that terminology is now correct. You know, as when we adopted the new regulations, we ditched off the term SUAS, so small unmanned aircraft systems. It's now just UAS, unmanned aircraft systems. You know, there's things like that that you need to start looking at. And we do have a service which I will plug called the HubSub. It's a monthly subscription, £9.99 a month. And that means that if you want your ops manual audited at any time, or you want it updated, or you want anything changed, new remote pilot, new aircraft, whatever it is, you let us know, we update it for you. And then, you know, you've always got an up-to-date operations manual. So, you know, some people leave it to the last minute again, you know, and just pay whatever it might be at the time. You know, for us, we've got a £149 ops manual update service that you could do once a year, but you shouldn't be leaving it to the last minute. Join up to the HubSub and always have your ops manual up to date, no matter when.
Yeah. That's it. And probably we should also mention that if you do submit all your paperwork, your ops manual, and there's something wrong with it, it's not updated or your flight logs aren't correct or other bits and pieces, the CAA can charge a fee, can't they, to sort of reevaluate your paperwork again. And I think that's £125 for that. So that's almost an updated ops manual already kind of, you know, paid for, I suppose, if you think of it like that. So yeah, they are very meticulous with what has to be correct, and they will bounce it back if there's anything wrong. So it is always good to just double check yourself and give yourself, again, it's all about time, give yourself enough time so you're not worried as well. Yeah, Matthew, was there something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think listening to the numbers laid out like that, honestly, it's a no-brainer, because I think, Adam, you said it's 149 odd pounds to have an ops manual evaluated and updated. In effect, if it's £10 a month, we're talking 120 a year. To have it updated at all times, it's literally a no-brainer to me. It just makes absolute sense. It's still important that you understand your document, but I think to have it professionally done, rather than keep chasing that yourself, makes all the sense in the world. I think you can focus on your business, you can focus on your equipment and your flying and maintenance, etc., and just not worry about that. It just makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'll agree with you there, Matthew, as well. okay, then. So we've spoken about the actual qualification. We know how to get the qualification now. So what does the qualification actually give us then? What's the benefit of having this qualification? So I think we'll kick off with Adam once again. So, Adam, what's it all about?
Okay, so we've already talked about this operational authorization. That is what you get from the CAA. Now, there's actually a little bit more that goes into it. What you apply for to get an operational authorization, it's actually something called a PDRA, a predefined risk assessment. Now, I would say that 99.9% of the people that are applying for a PDRA will go for PDRA 1, which is what I like to call standard permissions. That's what it used to be called. It's the one that everybody usually goes for. PDRA 2, just so you know, is basically for research and development of drones over 25 kilograms. There aren't currently, as of today, 13th of October, this has been shot, 2021, there aren't any other PDRAs. So you've either got PDRA 1, PDRA 2, and it's PDRA 1 that most people will apply for. So you get operational authorization, PDRA 1. And that allows you to operate any drone up to 25 kilograms in weight. So not maximum takeoff mass, 25 kilograms in flying weight. In what's called the
specific... That's different, isn't it? That's different. That used to be 20, didn't it? So they've upped it by another 5 kilos, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. So yeah, it used to be 20 kilos, now it's 25 kilos. So that allows you to now fly any drone up to 25 kilos in the specific category. So if you've got your A2 CFC, you're operating in the open category. You are limited by the bounds of the open category. The specific category is a little bit more flexible. That's why you get these operational authorizations from the CAA. So with PDRA 1, what effectively that boils down to is, like I say, any drone up to 25 kilograms in weight, you can then fly that down to 50 meters from uninvolved people, and you can technically overfly uninvolved people. We do advise that people limit the time doing so and only overfly people if you absolutely must. So you know, don't take it for granted that you can. You've got to minimize the risk. You can reduce the separation down to 30 meters from uninvolved people on takeoff and landing. So you know, as you're taking off, it's a 30 meter bubble effectively, and then it becomes a 50 meter bubble when you're essentially transitioned from takeoff into actual flight. And the sort of the last point is you've also got a 50 meter separation from assemblies of people, but there is no overflight of assemblies of people. So an assembly of people, just very quickly, is essentially if a person can't move out of the way of an out of control unmanned aircraft, they are classed as an assembly of people. So you know, if there's a small crowd of people and that person in the middle of the crowd can't move, it's an assembly of people. The whole area is classed as an assembly of people.
Right.
You can't overfly it, and you need to stay 50 meters away from it if you're operating under PDRA 1. You don't need to worry about any transitional provision. So if you've done the A2 CFC, you'll know what we're talking about here. you don't need to worry about C-class drones. It's any drone up to 25 kilograms, regardless of whether it's home-built or whether it's an off-the-shelf product.
Yeah, I think that's quite a big thing now, isn't it? A lot of people talk about this sort of the legacy aircraft that might or will be coming to an end at some point. And obviously, you can totally forget about that with this qualification, can't you? You can carry on using whatever drone you like, even your Phantom 1 if you really wanted to, and you could still do exactly what you wanted to do with it, you know, 5-6 years ago, which I think is a great advantage there too. Another thing on top of... Adam, I think...
I was going to say just one last thing, which I think is actually quite important to sort of tag on the end, is it allows you to fly these drones in congested areas, so areas used for industrial, yeah, residential, commercial, and recreational purposes. Without that, you're essentially operating in the open category, you know, depending on where you fall, but if we're talking the A3 subcategory, you've got to stay 150 meters away from these areas. So this is the key thing, is it allows you to fly any of these drones, any drone up to 25 kilograms in weight, in a congested area, as long as you can stay the required separation, so that 50 metres from uninvolved people.
Cool, yeah. Matthew, you had something else to say as well.
Yeah, Tom, I think it's also a good time to just sort of add a little bit to the conversation in terms of why you can get these permissions with those aircraft. People have sometimes said to me, you know, what difference does a piece of paper make to the safety of my aircraft? Why can I keep flying my Mavic down to 50 meters in the specific category if I can't in the open category? What makes the aircraft safer? And of course, the answer to that question is the aircraft isn't safer. The pilot and the operation as a whole are safer. And that's based on an assessment of your physical flying ability and more in-depth training, which makes you a more capable operator. I think I sometimes refer to driving, and I think much the same as the police are allowed to drive faster given circumstances and so on, or perhaps break laws, they're doing it because they have a specific purpose for it, and they're trained and skillful enough to be able to do that safely. And I think it's much the same thing. Once you've been through the GVC training and done your flight test, etc., you've then been assessed as being capable and safe enough to operate within congested areas with these aircraft. So it's not all about how safe the aircraft is and the sensors it's got on board and so on. If you give that aircraft to somebody who's inexperienced, who rushes off and flies in a confined space, they're very likely to have an accident, whereas you are not likely to have an accident. I hope that sort of added a little bit of clarity for some people.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's, yeah, exactly what we always talk about as well. You know, it is really important to have that kind of thought process tuned nicely. And another reason why we are then given the option to overfly people if we think it's safe to do so. And hopefully now we can judge that on a, you know, case-by-case basis, I suppose, really. But obviously the best thing to do is to never overfly someone, because then if the worst should happen, even if you can't control that accident, the aircraft will probably won't definitely hit anyone because you're not overflying them. And you can make that choice because you've been hopefully kind of taught to sort of go through those thought processes, I suppose, as well. So that's the idea behind it. Yeah, so I think, yeah, totally agree with all of that. And another bonus with this qualification, which wasn't accessible or didn't even exist, I don't think, with the PFCO, is the option to complete bolt-ons as well. Now, these are very new. They're still in development, and we do know of one or two, I suppose, really. The first one is going to be the extended visual line of sight bolt-on, which means, is it flying up to 1.5 kilometres, is it, Adam? Is that right? Or was it, I think, I'm going to put you on the spot,
I think,
now, aren't I?
Yeah, I think it's 1.5, yeah, 1.5, up to 1.5 kilometres from the remote pilot.
Yeah, that's right. So for certain people, that'll be brilliant. I think for survey work, I think that'll be really handy. Obviously, there are other things you have to think about. You don't just get a bit of paper and sort of off you go. You have to have spotters kind of along the line to make sure at least someone has a visual line of sight on the aircraft, and they can radio back to yourself as the pilot to give you instructions depending on what the aircraft's doing. And obviously, there's a bit more theory behind all of that as well. So that'll be kind of, as it says in the title, I suppose, really, a bit of a bolt-on course. And hopefully in the future, we'll see some more bolt-ons, which means you can really then flesh out this GVC qualification and get it to a point where you might be able to do quite a lot with this aircraft and your knowledge that normal people who only have a GVC or even an A2 couldn't even, you know, start, I suppose, as well, which is great too. So yeah, so I think that's that section covered as well. How are we doing for time? Yeah, that's looking good as well. So moving on then, if we wanted to sort of compare the two qualifications now, because like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, there'll probably be a lot of people who've gone through the A2 and they're thinking, well, you know, do I need the GVC? What's the difference? We've sort of explained the main differences, but let's talk about kind of the big ones, I suppose, really. So black and white comparison. So Adam, what do you reckon? What's kind of your biggest comparison, I suppose?
Okay, so I mean, obviously the biggest thing with the A2 CFC is the A2 CFC is primarily designed for C2 certified aircraft. So that's the big thing. That's actually what that was designed for. The second thing is the transitional provisions. So the transitional provisions end on the 31st of December 2022. So like I say, as of today, 13th of October 2021, we're just over 12 months away to allow you to fly what we call legacy aircraft under 2 kilograms with an A2 CFC. Whereas the GVC, getting this PDRA1 operational authorization, allows you to fly, again, any drone up to 25 kilograms. There is no transitional provisions, there's no deadlines or anything like that. There's no requirement for waiting for a certified drone. It covers all eventualities. So that's probably the biggest thing.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. And then following on from that, I imagine, me personally, I would say it's the kind of the bubble separation versus the column separation, I suppose, really. So obviously with the A2 CFC, the distances that you have to adhere to are just horizontal distances, which is obviously quite easy to sort of understand. Whereas with the GVC or the OA qualification, they now become either vertical or horizontal distances depending on the situation. So like I said, if you think of it like a bubble around the object as opposed to a cylinder around the object, then you can obviously utilize a bit more altitude to maybe get a better shot than what you could do with the previous A2 qualification. So I think that's quite a big one as well. Obviously, again, you use with caution, like we've mentioned before, but I think that's my personal kind of massive benefit to the GVC. I think that's... Do we think that's probably the main comparisons there? What do we think?
Well, you've got the 30 metres on takeoff and landing as well. So that's another big thing. Yeah. 30 metres on takeoff and landing with PDRA1. You don't get that with the A2 CFC. It's always that 50 metres horizontal. So I'd say that's, you know, that's a great bonus, especially if you are flying something like a Mavic 2 Pro. Obviously, yeah, it's a very small aircraft. If you're only ever going to fly a Mini 2, you know, very, very small aircraft, perhaps it isn't for you, you know, there won't be any benefit. But if you're flying something like a Mavic 2 Pro, that kind of size, then absolutely, you know, the GVC and this operational authorization, PDRA1, absolutely trumps over the A2 CFC.
Yeah, for sure. And I also think it's going to be kind of an industry standard, I think, moving forward, isn't it? Companies understood the PFCO, that was kind of their benchmark. Obviously, the A2 exists, but as people start to understand what the A2 is, they'll realise that there isn't a flight test. It's quite a lot more watered down. And so actually, we think in the future that the GVC will almost be, like I say, the benchmark. And because a company has signed you off with your flying, you have some sort of level there, which means you can be relied upon, hopefully. That's the idea. So a lot of companies might say, we need pilots, but you need to be GVC qualified, and that's it. So again, that might happen in the future too, I think. And same goes for insurance as well. It might potentially be slightly easier and maybe even cheaper to get proper commercial insurance cover with this qualification, because again, you are at a certain level and you're hopefully less liable, I suppose, for actually, or less risky for insurance companies as well, potentially too. So yeah, I think that's the comparison side of things sort of ticked off as well. So coming towards the end of the episode then, let's have a look lastly at our last point that we'll talk about. What are the next steps then after the GVC? So we've mentioned bolt-ons, and I think they are very good steps to work towards in the future. But let's say people are looking even further ahead, or what they want is a bolt-on that's ready now, or something similar to that. What could they do if they were desperate? So yeah, Matthew, what do you reckon? What could people do now if they had a job come in and, you know, that they needed better permissions? Is there an option at the moment?
There is, yeah, of course. So, Tom, I think we have spoken about this before on a previous podcast as well, that if people want to look for quite a detailed, in-depth talk about this, they can look for our podcast in which we interviewed Graham Digg. He's an expert in this and sort of very much in a position to help you if you're working towards an OSC. The OSC is what we're talking about. That is an operational safety case, which is, in effect, an application for additional permissions or special permissions which allow you to operate outside the scope of standard permissions, as Adam referred to earlier. So if you were looking for minimized separation, for example, you wanted to be able to take off and land with lower separation and perhaps be in flight closer to uninvolved people than standard permissions allow, then you would be looking at doing an OSC application through the CAA. This, however, is quite a process. This isn't something that you just quickly do in an off-the-shelf course. It's a very sort of specialized thing, which is requires quite a bit of detailed documentation and so on to achieve, but it certainly is possible. Adam, maybe you want to talk about the sort of documentation side of things. I know we're talking about a sort of 3-volume application that needs to be put through the CAA. Perhaps you can expand on that a little bit without going into too much depth as we did in the previous podcast.
Yeah, so it's what's called a 3-volume operating safety case. So the first one is about you and your company, effectively. The second volume is your system, so your whatever aircraft you're flying. So the volumes 1 and volume 2 are very much already what's already in your operations manual from doing your GVC. So you're a good way there, actually, with your operations manual provided at the end of the GVC course. But they get split out. So let's say volume 1 becomes about you, your company, and how you're going to operate. Volume 2 is your aircraft system. So rather than it being, you know, a couple of pages, it'll be a full, you know, perhaps 20 pages. You know, you've got to really look at the instruction manual and know it in and out. And then the third volume, which is probably the most crucial, in fact, is the most crucial of the safety case, is the safety management system, which is outlines how or why you should be given these special permissions. How are you going to make things safe enough for you to go down from that, you know, 50 meters from uninvolved people down to 10 meters potentially? You know, how are you going to make it safer? Is that going to be through through software or the hardware, through having maybe a ballistic recovery system, or, you know, whatever it might be? You've got to outline that, you know, and mitigate every risk as best as possible, so you can show the CA, and they'll go, okay, yeah, this person understands the risks, they understand how they're going to mitigate the risks, and they understand their aircraft. They need to, that needs to be clear as day when that lands on their, well, in their inbox, effectively. A big thing is, you know, I suppose it's a bit of a fallacy now that you need to have lots of experience, but I would say certainly you need to have some experience in a field. You know, if you're a relatively new remote pilot, you perhaps won't have that to fall back on straight away as, you know, as a justification why you should be given reduced distances. You know, it might be that, well, you've worked in a safety environment for, I don't know, 10, 20 years, and, you know, you understand the risks and how to mitigate risks. You know, perhaps you can add that in as part of your evidence. The more evidence you can show the CA, the more chances that they will give you a set of special permissions. And you need to have at the back of your mind what you want as well. So you can't, you shouldn't just go in there saying, well, I want special permissions down to 10 meters. You've got to kind of, if you, you know, if you do want to go down to 10 meters, by God, you're going to have to justify that if it's your first application. But, you know, they might look favourably on you to say, well, actually, for the first year, I want 30 metre reduced distances. You know, and then after you've got that 12 months under your belt, then you can say, well, actually, you know, I've operated for 12 months now safely. I've had no incidents. I've done this amount of work with it. Can I have 20 metres? This is how I've mitigated a little bit more. And then they might go, okay, yeah, fine, we'll give you that for another 12 months. You know, you work it down and down, hopefully, over a period of time. So that's pretty much the, it in a nutshell. But, you know, check out the podcast with Graham Degg from IELP Aerial. The other thing I will just point out is these are assessed by the CAA, so they are meticulous, and it does take weeks for it to go through. They really do scrutinise. It's not just like looking at, you know, a standard operations manual for PDRA1. It's tailored to you, your operations, and they need to really, you know, cross-reference. If you've said, you know, if you look in volume one, it references page 33 in volume two, subsection blah. By God, make sure it is in volume three under that, because they will look at that and go, well, actually, it's not there. You know, they will be meticulous.
We're not going to let this person fly anywhere near anyone. They can't even write their documents. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So, yeah, Adam, if there's a person or a team doing that level of assessment, I assume then that there's a relatively high cost involved, surely, that the CAA are charging for the process. Can you give us some input on that?
Yeah, it's about £1,700 at the moment for the initial application. So quite hefty, quite an investment. However, when you renew it, you know, in 12 months' time, it then goes down to about £500. So not quite as heavy hitting, but, you know what, it is going to set you apart from the rest of the crowd. You know, if you've got those special permissions, that means you can do more than the 95% of the other operators that are holding an operational authorization.
Yeah, you've just reminded me of part of the discussion that we had with Echo Alpha, where they spoke about that when they were sort of relatively cautious about the costs involved. And eventually, once they realized the potential benefit, they dived in the deep end and got their OSC, and they haven't looked back, and they've renewed it and extended it and sort of gained even better permissions since. So certainly they're an example of what's possible.
Yeah, it should pay for itself.
Yeah, that's it. I think if you've got jobs lined up, you know, wanting the permissions, then you've almost, you know, you're almost halfway there. Then you can justify it because you think, right, well, I can do those jobs, and that might pay for all of it or more potentially too, might it? So, yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. So, I think that's the OSC side of things nicely explained as well, and that probably will bring us to the end of this episode. So, hopefully, now everyone understands a little bit more about the GVC qualification. We've maybe removed some of the stigma behind it, I suppose, really, and actually, it's just kind of a more detailed A2 with an element of practical involved as well, and also the operations manual that explains your working practices in high detail as well. So unless anyone's got anything else to add, I think we'll bring this episode to a close. Adam, Matthew, anything to add? Or
I think that's covered most of it. So, as you've kind of already said, it's not a great leap if you're going from the A2 CFC to the GVC. You will find a lot of the theory content is recovered. In fact, some of the modules are exactly the same. You know, meteorology does not change. A cloud is a cloud. You know, I would say actually our A2 CFC course goes above and beyond the standard requirements So it does become a much more easier transition to go into the GVC, and you're just like, oh, actually, I already know this. It's like, yeah, because we've already set you up to go above and beyond what was required.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it's interesting the amount of knowledge that the CAA said they needed for that qualification. And yeah, we thought, hang on a minute, I think it makes more sense to actually give them these extra modules, because you need to know that. We're all flying an aircraft, aren't we, at the end of the day? It doesn't become, you know, less safe because you can do a slightly cheaper course, I suppose, too. So yeah, no, that's exactly right. Matthew, anything to add at all, or just a goodbye, maybe?
No, pretty much just a goodbye. Yeah, I think it's been a good episode. I think it'll certainly clarify things for a lot of people, and yeah, we look forward to welcoming them aboard when they decide to make that step up from the A2.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, brilliant. Well, anyway, thanks very much for listening, everyone. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and give us a review as well, if you don't mind too. And yeah, we'll see you all again soon, next week probably, for the next episode. So yeah, fly safe in blue skies, everyone. See you later.